48. BBC Radio 3, 2 o'clock, time to go live now to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of today's proms. It's presented by Louise Fryer.
Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Louise Fryer from BBC Radio 3. Radio 3, of course, home of the BBC Proms, and I'm your host for this Proms Saturday matinee. This weekend, the focus at the Proms is on youth once again, and this afternoon, members of the Ulster Youth Orchestra are going to share the platform with the Ulster Orchestra under the baton of Joanne Falletta. She's making her Proms debut. She's the Ulster Orchestra's recently appointed principal conductor. And they put together a rousing and inspiring programme, culminating after the interval in Stravinsky's suite for the ballet The Firebird. And there's a similarly fiery orchestral showpiece to start, Chabrier's España. And then in between, the players are going to reflect their Northern Ireland roots. Sir James Galway is the soloist for Mozart's Second Flute Concerto, and he also plays in the world premiere of Dark Hedges, a BBC commission from Elaine Agnew. It's a very exciting piece, and it's centred in the landscape of County Antrim, where she was born. So not one, but two orchestras are going to be performing, sometimes separately, sometimes together. The members of the Ulster Youth Orchestra have been working all summer with coaches at a residential course at Greenmount College, which is also in County Antrim. And the members of the Ulster Orchestra have acted as mentors and provided further coaching. We can hear the results immediately, as it's the young players who begin with the piece that in 1882 marked Ernest Chabrier's transition from gifted amateur to a composer of genius. Ravel and Debussy were influenced by this piece, and even Gustav Mahler declared, "España is the beginning of modern music." Joanne Falletta describes it as a tour de force for virtuoso orchestra, and the Ulster youth players really get a chance to shine. She's been impressed by their verve and their passion, and she says they have a real understanding of the swagger required for the dance rhythms. Well, we should be able to feel the warmth of the suns of Spain beating down on us. Niall McBride is already in position to lead the Ulster Youth Orchestra. And now let's welcome the first American and the first female principal conductor of the Ulster Orchestra, Joanne Falletta. Evoking the sights and sounds of the Iberian Peninsula, the sizzling orchestral impressions of the Frenchman Ernest Chambrier, the Ulster Youth Orchestra opening this Proms Saturday matinee with the principal conductor of the Ulster Orchestra, Joanne Falletta. Joanne, quick to bring the brass players to their feet, followed by each of the individual sections of the orchestra. One of the young players said when they first started rehearsing the piece, they were just playing the notes, but when Joanne arrived, she really brought them to Spain. Well, when Sir James Galway was a young musician, he left his home in Belfast and went to study in London and then in Paris, eventually becoming principal flute of the Berlin Philharmonic under Herbert von Karajan. He then embarked on a remarkable solo career, making countless TV appearances and touring widely. And in between, he now finds time to mentor young players through his international masterclass series. He's going to be playing with both the Ulster Youth Orchestra and the Ulster Orchestra in Elaine Agnew's BBC commission Dark Hedges. But first, he and the adult players come together in a concerto Mozart wrote originally for the oboe. It was the winter of 1777. Mozart and his mother were staying briefly in Mannheim before heading off to Paris. where Mozart made the acquaintance of a Dutch flautist, a wealthy amateur, who asked the 21-year-old composer to write a number of quartets and three concertos. Mozart managed one in G major, but for the next, he resorted to transposing his existing C major oboe concerto. Faced with writing a third, he seems to have given up entirely. And although it may sound like shirking, for James Galway, the quality of Mozart's music can't be doubted.
Oh, it's great for the flute. I mean, he's a very, very good arranger, Mozart. But I like it on the oboe too, you know. It was an oboe concerto and Mozart did rewrite it as a flute concerto. It's the first piece I ever played in the Albert Hall as a soloist a long time ago. And of course, having played it hundreds of times, you develop a way of playing it and you know the piece, you get into it more. It becomes part of you, you become part of it, and the whole thing functions on a totally higher level than normal. Well, I have a very good rapport with Joanne, and she does this concerto very, very well, and she took a lot of time to learn certain aspects of it, which many conductors don't do. For example, you know, in any concerto, in the allegros, you have the orchestra playing ding, 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 ding. You see, but they use the same bow stroke for that as they would in a slow movement. But in fact, they're accompanying a quick movement. So Joanne got them to play a little bit shorter, and it immediately gives a bit of air to the whole thing.
Sir James Galway, he has a strong relationship with the Ulster Orchestra. That applause just greeting their arrival on the stage. And he holds the position of Artist Laureate. Well, principal conductor Joanne Folletta has certainly appreciated working alongside Sir James on this concerto.
Somehow in his hands it always sounds fresh. I mean, he has a very, very brilliant approach to it, very brisk and lively tempos, and a sheer kind of enjoyment and verve of playing this great music. He has always had a very distinctive sound, a very beautiful sound, but also a sound with enormous projection. So it's a delight because we can accompany him and know that he's always singing right through us with this kind of golden sound that he has. That's his trademark. So it makes this piece even more special than it is when he plays it.
Joanne Folletta. Well, when Mozart's father endeavoured to chase him up about responding to the commission for the concertos, Wolfgang replied, "My mind gets dulled, as you know, when I'm supposed to write for an instrument I cannot stand." That excuse seems rather unlikely given the quality of Mozart's writing for the flute, not just in this concerto, but in his wind serenades, symphonies, and in his operas too. And the opening allegro and the andante of this three-movement concerto both have the feeling of an aria about them. The first frank and open, aperto, it's marked. The second soft and romantic, played not too slow before it's back to full speed for the closing rondo allegro. Well, there's been a complete change on stage here. The members of the Ulster Youth Orchestra have gone back behind the scenes, and replacing them, their adult colleagues in the Ulster Orchestra. Sir James Galway was saying how astonishing it is these days, the opportunities presented for young players. He certainly thinks they didn't exist when he was young. He was born in Belfast. He launched his solo career over 35 years ago, performing this very concerto when he made his solo debut at the Proms back in 1975. Well, that was with the Halle. Here he comes now to join the Ulster Orchestra, and with him, the conductor, Joanne Folletta, to conduct Mozart's Flute Concerto No. 2 in D major, K314.
Thank you.
Mozart's Concerto for Flute and Orchestra in D major, which Mozart plagiarised from his own Oboe Concerto in C. James Galway, the soloist, with the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta. Sir James, quick to shake her hand at the end there, and then turning to shake hands with the leader too. Known as the man with the golden flute, that's not just a metaphorical comment. His instrument is 24 karat gold, made especially for him in Boston by Nagahara. And with his name, Sir James Galway, engaged on the barrel. Sir James back at the front of the platform and encouraging Joanne Folletta to join him, taking hands together to receive this applause. He's still in great demand, snowy haired now, but still with a twinkle in his eyes.
This is a little piece I'm sure you all know. It's written by Johann Sebastian. Very good. And it's called the Badinery, and it goes like this. So I'm sure you all know that one.
James saving Twitter users the need to tweet the encore. That was the Badinery from Bach's Orchestral Suite in B minor. Sir James playing with the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Joanne Folletta. Well, he's still in great demand. He's going to be performing in Dublin at the start of September in a concert with the Emerson String Quartet before coming on tour here in the UK with the Orchestra of St John's, and later in the month he'll be performing at the opening gala for Buffalo Philharmonic, where Joanne Folletta is music director. He's also heading off on a tour of Asia, taking in the Beijing Festival and giving a New Year's Eve concert with the New York Phil. Well, after that classical piece, we're going to hear James Galway give the world premiere of a brand new work for flute and orchestra by Elaine Agnew. The players of the Ulster Orchestra are going to be sharing desks with those of the Ulster Youth Orchestra. So it's a huge number of players, and there's a big rejig of the stage going on. And that gives me a chance to talk to the composer, Elaine Agnew. Many thanks for joining me. From Northern Ireland. I wonder how that influences your work.
Well, the piece is called Dark Hedges, and whenever I receive the commission, and because it's really the cream of all the talent that we have in Northern Ireland, you know, it's our youth orchestras playing alongside their big brothers and sisters, and I really wanted to do something that was local and something that I think is visual that really stimulates, especially the young players. So I think as a starting point, I think it's really good with young players that they have immediately something to hold on to. And this avenue of beech trees up near Armagh in County Antrim is the most beautiful avenue of trees, and nobody knows of it unless you live quite close to the area. And I've always seen photos of it and always thought it was somewhere maybe in North America or in Australia where they have fabulous like landscapes with trees. And then only recently realised, oh, actually they're just up the road quite close to where I'm from. And thought, yeah, it's the way the beech trees have grown up and they've intertwined and they're going over the other side, and the light and the darkness and the shape. So to me, when you're standing at the avenue and you're looking right through the trees, it's like an orchestra of musicians, especially string pairs, all posed and ready to play.
Now, it's a very spatial piece, isn't it? There's an interesting arrangement here in the hall. You've got five percussion players out front on a kind of island in the middle of the arena. What's their part in the piece?
Well, whenever I was originally given the commission, the idea was to really have the opportunity to explore this fabulous space and not necessarily have all the musicians where you would expect them to be. And actually, there's quite a clatter of us as well. And I really love the idea of a real focus being put on the young players. So even though the wind, brass and strings are on the stage, they're divided. So visually you see the two separate wind and brass groups. I've merged all the strings. And then I decided that out in the front area in the arena that we would build a little purpose-built stage just for the UIO percussion. And Nick Brown from the Ulster Orchestra is doing a great job in conducting them and supporting them, keeping them together.
Well, let's hear from one of the young percussion players. This is Craig Lutton.
Atlantic News piece gives us the opportunity to improvise in three or four different sections using lots of different modern techniques, and also with Sir James Galway, he's playing harmonics on his flute and we're using flexitones and whirly tubes and all sorts of shakers and bowing vibraphones and bowing cymbals. So all those techniques describe the motion and the movement of the trees, the Dark Ages, which is up in County Antrim in Northern Ireland.
Craig Lutton, who's the principal percussionist with the Ulster Youth Orchestra. Now, Elaine, he mentioned the soloist there, James Galway, who's going to be moving from place to place during the piece. Tell me about that.
Well, there's a myth that goes with the Dark Ages that every night the Grey Lady appears and she wishes her way and vanishes. So the way the trees are is that there's about 150 trees on both sides, and the story is that she weaves her way at night time, and then when she comes to the last tree, she disappears behind it, and she represents all the lost souls. So I love the idea of the atmosphere of that. So I decided that the central section of the piece would really focus on James and the Ulster Youth Orchestra percussion, so that's really why they're up front. And the idea of having James playing in different places, so really exploring this fabulous space, from a different point of view. So he really represents the atmosphere of nighttime and this lady going whoosh as she weaves her way in. And the percussionists are playing a whole array of weird things. I spent last week in B&Q buying paintbrushes and sandpaper blocks, and it's just great what you can do with sound. Anything works.
There are some really fantastic effects. Well, we can hear a little bit more about the experience of working with you from the perspective of one of those young players.
It's been a really interesting project to work on. At the beginning, we weren't quite sure what to make of the music because it's very different to anything that any of us have ever played before. But I think it's the kind of piece that you can really interpret in your own way, and having Elaine there was so helpful. I mean, you don't always get the chance to have the composer there. When we play Brahms or Beethoven or whatever, we don't have that luxury of having the composer there. So having Elaine there to be able to tell us why she'd written something and what effect she wanted was really useful. I think it made the music a lot more accessible to us when she was able to kind of paint these images for us that we needed to kind of interpret into our playing. So it was a great experience. I mean, we've really grown to love this piece. I think it really underlines the importance of promoting new works as well as music that's been around for centuries. It's great to be able to be a part of that and to be the first orchestra to ever perform this in the Royal Opera at the Proms. It's amazing. It's fab.
Maeve Martin, who's one of the first violins. Well, that excitement is palpable, I think. Elaine Agnew, many thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy hearing your piece performed for the very first time here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, it's a massive orchestra assembled on stage, around about 150 players. And to conduct them, here comes Joanne Folletta. As Sir James Galway takes up his position in the arena. the world premiere performance of Dark Hedges by Elaine Agnew, given here at the Proms by the Ulster Youth Orchestra, the Ulster Orchestra, and soloist James Galway, conducted by Joanne Folletta. Elaine Agnew threading her way through all the many musicians on stage and planting a kiss firmly on the cheek of the leader, and then gesturing to the five percussionists at the front of the stage, also with their conductor, Nick Brown. He often plays as a percussionist with the Ulster Orchestra. He's been standing on the island in the arena, 10 metres or so behind Joanne Folletta, and perfectly mirroring her moves. Well, that BBC commission inspired by a tunnel of trees in County Antrim, where Elaine Agnew grew up. And just listen to the reception to that fascinating piece, one to watch as well as hear. Things going on all the time. The paintbrushes that Elaine mentioned, incidentally, were used by the harpists to tickle the strings of their instruments, creating a ghostly, shimmering sound. And the percussion players had a whale of a time, including whirling a green plastic corrugated tube in the air, the kind of thing I remember playing with when I was little. You may have heard the audience chuckle at that point. And also greeting with some humour the appearance of the Swanee whistle. Elaine Agnew again coming to the front of the stage. Cheers for her from the audience and from all of the almost 150 players on stage. If anyone can remember the name of those whirly tubes, do let me know. You can tweet me at that Louise Fryer. And if you have a response to that piece, do tweet that too at BBC Proms. Well, poetry is often a source of inspiration for Elaine Agnew. Joanne Folletta is also a poet. Both of them back at the front of the stage now with Sir James Galway. He was a travelling musician during that piece, threading his way through the Promise to join the percussion players on their island before finally ending up at the front of the stage, in a more usual position for a soloist. Elaine Agnew studied with, among others, James McMillan, and his Olympic fanfare is premiered in this evening's Prom, kicking it off at 7:30. And then on Tuesday, the BBC Philharmonic and a collection of choirs will give the world premiere of Credo, James McMillan's keenly awaited new choral work. Well, the combined Ulster Youth Orchestra and Ulster Orchestra turned to Stravinsky after the interval with the 1911 suite from The Firebird. But having heard James Galway in this first half of the Prom playing his gold flute during the interval, another flautist, Keith Waith, takes Julian May on a world tour of the instrument, which appears in many guises almost everywhere. In the global flute fraternity, we hear first from today's soloist.
I'm James Galway, and I play something pretty pricey, a golden flute. But usually I have one of the world's cheapest instruments about me too.
This afternoon, James Galway is playing one of his more expensive instruments, the sophisticated concert flute, rather than that penny whistle. But these are distant cousins in the same family, instruments that are hollow pipes with holes which you blow. And there are flutes of all sorts all over the world. I've come to see a man who knows more than most about this global flute fraternity, Keith Waith. Keith is a flautist and composer originally from Guyana. He's played in South America and North America, Africa, India and Europe. And everywhere he goes, he finds flutes. And I'm going to look at his collection now.
Oh, welcome, Julia.
Hi, yes. Keith. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Oh, this is amazing. I'm in Keith's kitchen now, and there's the dining room table, but you can hardly see it, for flutes of all different kinds. And Keith, tell me, how many flutes have you got?
I've been collecting since 1977, and I've now got 207 flutes from all over the world, because I discover, you know, Julian, every country I've gone to, there's a flute. Every country's got a flute, so, and I've got this passion for them.
I can see things here that look like flutes, wooden flutes. There's a piccolo here. But there are some rather strange instruments as well that I wouldn't recognise as flutes. This, it's a clay thing. It's a kind of teapot.
Yes.
How is that a flute?
Well, I think it's all the blowing, you see, because it reminds me of a genie's lamp. I've learned some technique of blowing into it as a single song for the birds in my backyard. And I can flutter my tongue, so I'm using all the techniques of the flute. That's fluttering the tongue. And they get it louder and longer. So all the techniques that you use on the flute.
You've got another clay instrument here.
Yes, it's an ocarina.
And a sweet potato.
And every morning I'm up with the birds. And the birds respond. And I have this little story to tell the kids that, you know, birds don't like Chinese music first thing in the morning. So I play this with my birds in my backyard. And then the birds just fly away.
Keith, there's one incredible piece here. Is this thing an instrument? It's actually it's a band, isn't it?
Drummer.
It's terracotta figures all joined together.
Yes.
A drummer.
Saxophonist. Clarinet player. Cymbals.
And they're all painted rather beautiful. Where's this from?
From Peru. And the great thing about it is that there's a hole at the back of it. So the sound comes through the holes of the back of each player. And it sounds like this. It's just beautifully decorated.
I've never imagined, actually, flute instruments made out of the... I mean, really, they're made out of the earth.
Earth, that's right, yes. Natural things. And these figures, I just love the way the eyes are so real, so regal too.
Mm, wonderful. So we have clay, but you have something even more basic than that, don't
you?
Yes,
and this is very old. It was found in Guyana, in the Waiwai tribe. And they're the first original people in Guyana. And this is made of bone. Fortunately, it's a deer bone. And it's unique, really, because they use the end of the bone to generate the sound. And it has only three holes, where most flutes have six holes to get different pitch. And you blow across the top of the flute, the bone, and it sounds like this. Now, there's a saying that if you're not thinking beautiful thoughts, Julian, you wouldn't get a song. I wouldn't get a song. So we need thinking about flowers, shanti, and things like that.
Yeah, okay.
Let's try it now. Clean thoughts. So this is from Guyana in South America.
Now, I've been to the British Museum where there is a bone flute that is 30,000 years old. Just when people were inventing mathematics, they were inventing musical instruments.
Yeah.
And here, you see, a bone will be hollow anyway.
That's right.
You just have to drill a few holes in it and make some kind of a mouthpiece.
Yeah.
So what you've got here is really one of the most basic...
Absolutely. You know, there's no sophisticated ways of making holes. But what is look how smooth and even. What they would have used to make that?
It's phenomenal.
Keith,
this one is made out of deer bone.
Yeah.
But that wasn't always the case, was it?
No, not really. In the days when an Amerindian person kills the enemy, they would use part of the leg to make a flute.
So you'd really defeated your enemy when you had his shin bone. And you were using it to make music.
That's correct, yes, yeah. And that's the ultimate embarrassment, I think, the enemy. Slay them, but also to make a flute out of the shin bone.
Right, that was the worst thing that could happen to you, is to be turned into a flute. Right.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so look, those are from the Americas. Yeah. Where would you like to take me on your global journey now?
I really want to go to West Africa, Ghana in particular, because I remember going there with my band of Makusi players. We were there touring for something called Panafest, and I met the chief of the country, and he and I got on very well, and he said, listen, I think you're named from your mannerism, from the way you look and speak, you could be a Ghanaian. And he called me Kwame. But in doing that, he gave me this instrument called the Atentiben flute, which is a bamboo flute, but uniquely, the holes are all placed to the left, to the right. So it starts straight down the middle of the flute, and then it suddenly curves to the right.
That's interesting, because of course our fingers are not straight, are they?
No,
they
that's
also
right.
curve slightly.
So fingers to curve. Mm. And I've written this piece called Leaf Falling Atentiben, because I remember when we were there, you can see it was a windy evening, and when I was presented with this bamboo flute, the Atentiben flute. And it's just beautiful the way you get a resounding deep sound.
Now, this flute from Ghana, it's only about a foot long. It's quite wide.
Yeah.
It's completely unadorned. But you have flutes. There's one over here which is about 3 feet long. Well, go and get that one for me. Tell me about that one.
Well, this one here is from India, and it's called a bansuri. It's a difficult flute to play because
it's at the other side of the room.
Room, that's right. Stretching to reach it. Yeah. It's a very thick, even thicker than the Atentiben flute, and it's very long, and the holes are widely placed. And there's someone who's more obsessive about flutes than myself, called Panelo Ghosh, and what he used to do is to cut part of his finger to stretch. To get a stretch to play it. This messy, messy kind of thing.
So hang on. In order to stretch, to get these, he would cut between his fingers. So he could stretch them wider and wider. He must have been very dedicated.
I don't think it's dedication. I think what I've discovered, that if you stretch your finger using the joints of your fingers,
right.
You get the same effect. Less brutal.
Yeah. A bit like the way bagpipe players play, with the ends of their fingers, but exactly the
same. So I've just discovered that, and that's what I was taught in Bombay, and it's a beautiful. Well, you hear the sound, but what's nice about this? It has sort of nice threading that keeps it from splitting, especially in this change of climate.
So this is like the whipping you'd get on a fishing rod to hold.
Yes.
Right. Mm. And so if it splits, it will
hold it
tight.
Yes.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
Somehow, there's something about that flute that sounds Indian.
Yes, yeah, and I use some of the quarter tones because, for instance, it gives you the facility to... So it gives you the facility to do quarter notes, half notes.
So what you're doing here, Keith, is you're partly covering
a hole,
and then you're sliding your finger up so you can bend the notes and...
You can hear it bending, and that's how you get a quarter tones that is very frequent in Indian music.
Brilliant. So that's India.
Yes.
Keith, among these 207 flutes you have spread out on your kitchen table, I see that you have some bamboo flutes from China. They've got Chinese writing on them, and flute playing is a big cultural activity in China, and their flutes are very, they have a very distinctive and beautiful sound.
Yeah, well, these two were originally, they were a gift to me from my Chinese friend when we were both studying in the 70s. Because he was the one who told me, oh, you must get our flutes from China because they're so unique. And he was so right. The top section of it has a love story written in Chinese in green or blue. But as you come down, one flute has a peacock and the other one has a dragon.
I mean, this is very interesting because you have a musical instrument here, but it's carrying a piece of literature,
yeah.
Chinese Romeo and Juliet,
yeah.
And a piece of Chinese visual art as well.
Yeah.
That's very inclusive, isn't
very,
it?
Very, very much so, and cross-curricular.
So, Keith, can you play me one of these works of
yeah,
art?
Yeah, sure, I can. Chinese flutes, they have an extra hole just below the mouth hole, usually covered by rice paper.
So they put rice paper on because as you blow, it will vibrate.
But I get the same effect by using my throat. That sort of sound. And then I put it onto the flute. So when you hear me play it, you get the same vibration. Can you hear that?
I love not just the vibrato, but the sort of the breathiness as the note dies. So we've been all around the world now with your flute collection, Keith. But what about Europe? Because that's where you live now.
Yeah.
Is there a European flute you like?
Oh, yes. My European flute is a C flute. It's my favorite, but also use the alto flute for compositional work and effects.
So these are the kind of flutes that that James Galway
James
would be playing.
Plays,
though yours are silver rather than gold.
That's right.
Yeah. You've got this wonderful alto flute. This is quite a sophisticated instrument then, compared with the bone flute with three holes.
That's right.
There's a lot of plumbing on this flute, and you can do amazing things with it, I think.
Yes, and also because I've tried to push the boundaries as much as I can. So I'm going to develop a piece of music, which is I call the flute fraternity theme, and it's really about using the rock guitar pedal to give me the layers that I need to create this piece of music. And I'm using both the alto flute to start with, and I go in, and then I end up with the C flute.
So we're sitting in Keith Waith's kitchen. He's got two flutes on his lap, some pedal paraphernalia here. And Keith, you're going to give us a brief example of what you can do with layering sound.
Sound okay. And on the pedal, yeah.
Thank you. Keith, many musicians try to get rid of the extraneous sounds of their instruments, so that, you know, some accordion players really don't like it if you can hear the buttons rattling on their instruments. But you, it seems to me, relish the sounds of the mechanics of your flutes. Is that you're interested in the way they work? Yeah. Is that so?
Well, that's true, because one of the things I do with the flute that I create, I use every instrument to its full capacity. And all this came when I went to India and how they use the breathiness. I went to Africa and they use all the bird songs and the wind songs. For example, this sort of thing, using the keys of the flute. And then I create something from the rainforest. And the wind sounds. And then, of course, you know, kids always love animal sounds. Or the laughing flute. So, yes, I use it to its full capacity. And also with the blowing, I can still create the breathiness.
And can you sing and play the flute at the same time?
Well, you can, yes. Oh, yeah, anything's possible. Like when I'm doing my jazz. Come on. Three, four.
Keith, you have more than 200 flutes from all over the world now. But actually, when you first came to Britain, you weren't a flute player, were you?
No, I was here as a trumpet player. But it was during that time at the Royal Military School of Music I discovered the flute and the techniques. And I just fell in love with it. I just love the flute and, you know, the things you can do and just take it into different directions. And also bringing joy to other people. So it's just wonderful. And being able to experiment with the different flutes.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Julian.
Keith Waith, the flautist with 207 instruments, talking to Julian May, producer of the Global Flute Fraternity, on a world tour. That was what they were undertaking in his kitchen. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and this Proms Saturday matinee with me, Louise Fryer. The Ulster Youth Orchestra are teaming up with their coaches and mentors in the Ulster Orchestra for this prom under the baton of Joanne Falletta. In the first half, the two orchestras played together in the premiere of a BBC commission from Northern Ireland composer Elaine Agnew. Lots of positive comments here in the hall and about that piece on Twitter. And many thanks to Peter Ashman, who's tweeted to tell me that a whirly tube is also known as a lasso d'amore, a carugaphone, and even a bugle resonator. Well, whatever it's called, it was certainly the focus of lots of discussions amongst the prommers during the interval. Alongside youth, there's a focus on theatre music in this prom season, and this second half of the concert is devoted to the suite Stravinsky put together from his first ballet for Diaghilev's Ballet Russe, The Firebird. When Stravinsky arrived in Paris for the final rehearsals in 1910, Diaghilev described him as a man on the threshold of fame. Prophetic indeed. The ballet tells the story of a prince who, with the aid of the magical firebird, releases a group of princesses from the spell cast by the evil magician King Kashkai. The prince falls in love with the most beautiful of the princesses and marries her. Stravinsky produced his first suite from the ballet in 1911. 8 years later, he created a revised version for a smaller orchestra and revisited the suite again in 1945. It's the earliest of those suites that we'll be hearing this afternoon, calling for a huge number of players, around about 150, gathered on stage. Joanne Falletta and the two orchestras have been rehearsing it together over the past week. For the woodwind, it's going to be the younger players who'll be taking the solos, and for all the young players, and it's an exciting prospect.
This is a fantastic experience because there's over 150 of us in the combined orchestras, and it's just the sound, even just being in the orchestra, is immense.
The Albert Hall is great for playing in because it's such a vast hall, but you can hear every player. Standing out there a minute ago, you could hear the harpist playing from right at the top. So even though it's such a huge hall, the sound just carries so well.
You're sitting in the percussion section and the timps and percussion and away up high, and you're looking over all the orchestra and you can feel the whole atmosphere of all the musicians playing. It's great, especially in the last movement. Movement 5 of the Firebird is fantastic.
I have the pleasure of being the Ulster Youth Orchestra Principal Oboe, so today I've got quite a lot of solos to do in the Firebird. I've had a lot of support from the Ulster Orchestra players that we've been rehearsing with over the last couple of days. Christopher Blake, who's the Principal Oboe with the Ulster Orchestra, has been helping me a lot, sort of sitting beside me and making sure that I'm playing out. And so that's going to be great to have sitting beside me today.
That was percussionist Andrew Collins, violinist Paul McCusker, percussionist Craig Lutton, and Principal Oboe Carolyn Kelly. Looking forward to this performance at the Proms. Members of the Ulster Youth Orchestra, and here to conduct them in the suite from Stravinsky's The Firebird is Joanne Folletta. in the course of his career. Stravinsky reckoned he conducted that work in one form or another over 1,000 times. From his ballet, The Firebird, that was the 1911 suite, ending with the Infernal Dance played by the Ulster Youth Orchestra and the Ulster Orchestra sharing desks, conducted by Joanne Valletta. Well, the New York Times calls her one of the finest conductors of her generation. She's cool, calm, collected, very clear, fantastically neat in appearance, in her habits and in her conducting style. What a moment for these young performers to play side by side with their adult colleagues. Joanne making her way back onto the platform. The orchestra led by Joanna Petku-Collin. But she's bringing to her feet the young oboist Carolyn Kelly, really making her mark in this Stravinsky piece. The flautist Christian Swain. The first clarinet, Eve Wilczniek. And the first bassoon, David Bennett. And the first flute, Amy Consiglia. Clarinetist Peter Rogers. And all of the wind soloists, standing cor anglais player Sarah Castelli. And the horn, Michael Bell. All of the members of the Ulster Youth Orchestra. Joanne Valletta reaching out as though she would embrace them. And those cheers are for the horn section. And all of the brass now being brought to their feet along with the rest of the woodwind. And the percussion players, the timpanist Craig Lutton, who we were hearing from earlier. So Joanne Valletta making her way around the entire huge orchestral forces massed here at the Royal Albert Hall. Looking back, Stravinsky wrote, "The orchestral body of the Firebird was wastefully large," but the audience here have really responded to the sheer force and power of the masked musicians on stage, as well as the thrill of Stravinsky's orchestration. Well, Joanne Valletta, very keen on music education, and the fruits of that certainly has been in evidence this afternoon, and there's plenty more to come as the weekend unfolds. But for now, back to Broadcasting House and David Cornett.
Well, that was Louise Fryer, and there's another chance to hear this afternoon's prom on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. Well, we've returned to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom this evening at 7:30 for music by Varese, Nicole Muli, Messiaen and Anna Meredith. And that'll be performed by the National Youth Orchestra of Great Britain. And the conductor of the National Youth Orchestra is Vasily Petrenko. As I said, it starts at 7:30.
On Radio 3, from the BBC Proms, the music of Ivor Novello, introduced by Simon Callow.
Novello, to me, means romance, generosity, bigness of spirit, music that comes out of a full heart, melodious and indeed rather melodically inspired, but above all innocent and tender, but very nostalgic stuff, very, very touching. Join me for a musical tribute to one of the most successful composers for British musical theatre, a celebration of Ivor Novello.
Thursday night at the BBC Proms.
From 10:15.
Well, coming up next this afternoon is a second opportunity to hear last Monday's recital from Cadogan Hall of our BBC Proms chamber music recital. That's at 4:15. Now, if you were with me just about 2 hours ago, you may remember that we played a little gap with a spot of Bach. We heard the Prelude number 21 from the Well-Tempered Clavier from Book 1. And at the end of it, I said, well, it was crying out to hear the fugue. And we didn't hear the fugue, of course, because we just didn't have time. Let's hear the jolly old thing now. And it's played by Glenn Gould, thankfully not singing along. Thank you. waiting for 2 hours to hear that. The Fugue number 21 from the B-flat major, Prelude and Fugue from book one of the 48 by Bach, played by Glenn Gould. Well, as I said, our next programme is BBC Proms Chamber Music from last Monday, coming up now in 17 minutes' time. We change pianists. Leslie Howard is the pianist now, with some music transcribed by Liszt. It's music by Chopin, 17 Polish songs, opus 74, and this is six of them. I think we are going to have time, in fact, to hear all six. As I said, transcribed by Liszt and played by Leslie Howard.
Thank you.
transcriptions by Liszt of 6 of the 17 Polish songs by Chopin, played by Leslie Howard. BBC Radio 3, it's 4:15. Time now for an edited repeat of last Monday's Proms Chamber Music Concert. The presenter was Clemency Burton-Hill.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall for the third concert in this year's Proms Chamber season, which promises to be an unusual and inventive recital from the period instrument ensemble L'Arpeggiata. They'll be exploring the phenomenon of tarantismo across the ages. Now, human fascination with the entrancing ritual dance of the tarantella, which can supposedly heal the deadly bite of the tarantula, goes right back to Greek mythology. Over the next hour, we're going to hear a programme that spans the early Baroque to the contemporary era. Now, in today's genre-busting prom, L'Arpeggiata will be joined on stage also by dancer Anna Dago, as well as singers Raquel Andueza and Vincenzo Capizzuto, all of whom are making their debut at the prom. So let's welcome them onto the stage now for this prom's chamber recital. Thank you.
Thank you. giù passata, quando l'angelo è volata, quando l'angelo è volata, che giù passata. Una voce mi ripeto, non perdere più tempo, circa essere felice. Non perdere più tempo, circa essere felice. Circa essere felice, non ci sta tempo. E cantano l'uccelli, cantano soltanto quando è santo il pensiero. E cantano soltanto quando è santo il pensiero. Quando è santo il pensiero, canta l'uccello. A voi che come rosa, quando parlerà amore, leve spine in te parola. Quando parlerà amore, leve spine in te parola. Le vespini in te parola si dice amore. A vita è come a morte, stanno vicino a casa, non si può una piccica. Stanno vicino a casa, non si può una piccica. Non so può una piccica, so una cosa. E tu figlia Maria, tu non sei manca nata, già sei stato condannata. Tu non sei manca nata, già sei stato condannata. Già sei stato condannata, appena nata. Quella che è stata creata, quella che è stata creata, non ce l'hanno mai imparata, non ce l'hanno mai imparata, chi stu creata.
Thank you.
Buona femmina fa, vuoi entrare nella tua voce?